This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We've heard many times that the key to getting out of poverty is education. But schools cost money, something that is in short supply in the most impoverished areas of the world. That's a problem that Jim Zielkowski has spent the last 20 years trying to solve.
I was overwhelmed and almost gave up there, but then I realized if we could get this school built, maybe they could break that cycle of extreme poverty through education.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the beginnings of the nonprofit called Build On that's helping the poorest around the world find education, including right here in the U.S. We'll also spend an academic minute with smokers and their families. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Twenty-one years ago, Jim Zielkowski was a student in the financial management program at GE Capital. But a backpacking jaunt to Nepal showed him how simple generosity could change the lives of the impoverished, from the plains of Africa to the inner cities of the U.S. In his new book, Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World?, he tells the story of how he started struggling to get funding for a small school building project and wound up founding the worldwide nonprofit Build On. We spoke recently, and I asked if he thought the book would become such a personal story when he started out.
I did not. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever done, especially writing about my son and my father and some other occurrences that were deeply personal. But, you know, I had a phenomenal co-writer, Jim Hirsch, who I admire, love, and respect tremendously. And because of that trust that I had with Jim, I was able to write very openly and candidly about some of the biggest challenges in my life.
And I think writing about your personal experiences gives a little more insight into the organization. You started out as, you know, just a guy working in a cubicle at GE Capital, and the relationship with GE really helped build what you ended up building, don't you think?
Oh, it did. I had spent, before I took the job with GE, I worked a couple of jobs and saved some money and backpacked and hitchhiked around the world and spent a lot of time and most of my time in developing countries and was really overwhelmed by extreme poverty. And even in Nepal, which suffers tremendously from extreme poverty, it was very difficult for me. And until I was passing through a village on my way up into the mountains where they were celebrating the opening of a school, and it was a two-day celebration, Bob. They never went home. And it was amazing. And so now I'm seeing not just the injustice of extreme poverty, but also the determination and the hope around education that these folks had. And when I came back to the U.S., you know, I saw poverty in America in a much different way and saw the challenges and injustices of poverty, especially in American inner cities, and wanted to act on it, but chickened out. And moved in the other direction. I took a fast-track position with GE, and it took me 15 months after that to get the courage up to leave and start up Build On.
And you started up with the goal first of building three schools overseas. Now, how did that goal start? Where did you say, okay, that's how I'm going to begin?
Bob, I don't have a good answer to that question. In hindsight, it would have been much easier if we built three schools in one country instead of on three different continents, but clearly the most difficult project that we ever have had in these 550 schools that we've built was in Africa, the first project in Missomali Village. We faced insurmountable challenges. You know, the community came together behind the project, and we were going to live in the village for the entire duration and really learn from the community how to unite and build. But then I collapsed with a 104-degree fever, lost consciousness, and you know, by the grace of God, my brother Dave was able to drag me into one of two hospitals that they had in the country, and I had malaria. And after a couple of days, came out of it, and the doctor came in and told me two more hours away from this hospital, and I would have been dead. And I was very much shaken up by that, but decided to go back to the village alone this time to try and finish building the school. And as I'm walking into the community, I realized that when these villagers contract malaria, they don't have a near-death experience. They die. And, you know, why did I survive and they don't? It's extreme poverty. And so I was overwhelmed and almost gave up there. But then I realized if we could get this school built, maybe they could break that cycle of extreme poverty through education. And so, you know, things happen for a reason. In hindsight, we probably wouldn't have done three schools on three continents, but we did, and we learned tremendously from generous people that are overcoming the most extreme challenges around the world.
You started the organization Building with Books, which later became Build On. It's really a two-pronged organization, as I see it. You have your school building overseas, but you do have work you do with schools in the United States. Tell us about that part.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bob. So we run intensive after-school programs in urban high schools around the U.S., and we mobilize students to do something they always wanted to do, and that's service. They do a very direct service, working with elders, homeless people, younger children in their own communities to turn their own communities around. And at the same time, these kids help build schools in developing countries. And at this point, you know, we're working in Detroit, Chicago, Oakland, San Francisco, the South Bronx, Harlem, East New York. We're in Connecticut, Philadelphia. These kids have contributed collectively over 1.1 million hours of service. And we've now built over 550 schools in developing countries around the world. And it's, you know, 95% of the kids that we work with, even from the most challenged schools in those cities, not only graduate, they go to college. So there's something very special happening there. And I think it really speaks to the nature of service and the transformational abilities that it has.
And you've always been hands-on with a lot of the kids. And there was one who really struck me in the book. You did not use his real name. You called him Johnny in the book. Tell us about your relationship with him.
I got to know Johnny very well. Met him for the first time in Nicaragua. And he, you know, went on to become a part of my family. He lived with my wife and my two boys and I for quite some time. And you know, Johnny is a kid who grew up in very tough circumstances. They had absolutely no money. Both parents were unemployed. They had been evicted 9 times in 12 years. And Johnny, you know, had to defend his mother against his stepfather with a baseball bat at certain points. You know, and they were getting food from homeless shelters. And he just had such an intensely difficult circumstance. And when I met him in Nicaragua, you know, I saw how hard this kid was working and how he connected with his host family. Every spare minute he spent with his host family, you know, and it happened to be that he was living with like the economically poorest family in the village, which is saying a lot. And I went up there and got to know his family a little bit, his host family, and also, you know, see the way he really spent time with them. Now, 2 days before we left, I was with Johnny and his family, and he sat down and the whole family's together, and you know, he's got his head down, and he everybody's wondering what's the matter, and he looks up and he said, "I don't know how I'm going to say goodbye to you guys tomorrow," and he said, "This has been the best 2 weeks of my life," and he meant it, the best 2 weeks of his life. And Buenaventura, the host father, stood up and embraced Johnny, and he said, "You are my son now, and you will always be part of this family." You know, and that's and Buenaventura was in tears when he said this, which is so rare. It's incredible. So, you know, that's something that nobody can ever take away from Johnny. That kid came back, and he's done hundreds and hundreds of hours, over 500 hours of service to transform and turn his communities around. He's been subjected to, you know, violence, and he was selling heroin at the age of 13. Now he's cleared out of that, graduated high school on time, and is doing really well. So, again, you know, these youth are the heroes, and I wanted to write the book to give voice to them and give them the recognition that they deserve.
How do you choose the schools that you use in the U.S. to be a part of Build On?
Well, we look at the communities where they're situated. We look at the resources that they have, and we try to invest and concentrate our resources in the more challenging communities, in places where the schools don't have other programs or other resources available, and where there are significant challenges in the neighborhood. And so, you know, we've made some choices to be in some schools that others have frankly left behind and don't think have a lot of hope to strive and thrive. And what we have seen are heroic teachers, you know, coming together and working hard in partnership with us and really connecting with kids. And it's making an enormous difference on a multitude of levels.
Well, the other question is pretty obvious. How do you choose where you build schools overseas?
Similar. We go to the economically poorest countries on the planet, and we assess the need for education, which is pretty straightforward. We see direct correlations between extreme poverty and illiteracy. So we assess based on economic need. Then we look for stability, and we look for the ability of the ministries of education to provide teachers where we build these schools. So once that part is assessed, we go to the community level and we talk to village elders and leaders and see not only that they need schools, but do they want to build them? Because they contribute all the unskilled labor to build these schools. And if they do want to build them, then they have to sign a covenant committing to that contribution, which is up to 2,000 volunteer work days for a single school. And they've got to send their daughters to school in equal numbers with their sons. And we ask them to sign a covenant. And there are some powerful metrics on attendance and on gender balance in these classrooms because of that approach and because the community members lead the projects and help to build the schools.
And wasn't putting together that covenant something you learned after those first three schools?
Well, we learned it in Miss O'Malley Village, that place I referred to a few minutes ago. When we saw how the community came together, we knew we had to build methodology around that. And I got to tell you that I had not gone back, Bob, in almost 20 years. And I'd lost a lot of good friends in that village and decided that it was time. I had to go see if the school was still standing. We built a school. About 150 kids were attending when I left. When I got to the community, I was initially devastated because our construction supervisor, his entire family, they died from AIDS, and the chief died from AIDS. And my closest friend in the village, this guy who really had my back, Stephen, I couldn't find him. And finally, he emerged from this crowd. Everybody was celebrating, my return in some ways. And then Stephen emerges and takes me to the center of the village, and I am stunned because I don't know which school we built. Instead of one school and 150 kids, there's five schools and 1,000 kids attending school. These schools, every single day, 533 of them girls. They went on to build four of these schools without us, you know. And then Stephen introduced me to this 20-year-old woman, and it was his daughter. I held her in my arms when she was an infant, and he explained to me, he said, you know, I'm an illiterate man, you know, but my daughter went to the school that we built together. She went to all five of these schools, and now she's an educator. She became a teacher. He said, Ruthie, my daughter, she will lift up my family's name forever. And so from his story, I draw so much courage and inspiration. And you know, that's really the full circle in the impact that we can have when the community leads, when we put them in front.
Still to come, my conversation with Jim Zielkowski, the founder of Build On, continues with the story of his trip and stay in South Africa in the dying days of apartheid. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1203. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Jim Zielkowski, the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Build On. We're talking about his new book, Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? And in the book, he tells the story of a trip he took to South Africa. During his stay in the country, he took a lot of film detailing the conditions after the release of Nelson Mandela, but before the end of apartheid. I asked what happened to that footage and to describe his experience in the country.
Well, the answer to your first question is the film's all available, and Simon & Schuster has been generous enough to produce an enhanced e-book. So we've got the footage that I referred to as I was writing the book in the enhanced e-book. You can see some of the things I was doing there and some of the sacrifices that some of the folks in the ANC made to help to make that possible. In terms of that experience, you know, seeing the injustice, not just of extreme poverty, but of apartheid, which in my view was really fueled by lack of access to education, really inspired me. It helped me to think about the mission of Build On and take it out of just the circumstances of poverty and really make sure that education is available. And what we do is a tool for social justice to help to liberate people through education. And we've had that experience in Nepal, where we work with people that were formerly enslaved. We've had the experience in Haiti. We've had it all over the world. Education is something that liberates in so many different ways.
And you did get to meet and interview Mother Teresa before she died.
I did. Yeah, that was a gift. I was on my way to Calcutta to visit my brother John on my way to Nepal, and the kids in our program back here in the U.S. said, well, you got to, you know, sit down with Mother Teresa and ask. They had all these questions they wanted me to ask. And I said, I'm not going to, I mean, come on. I mean, I'll take your questions with me and I'll ask them, but I don't think I'm going to be able to talk to Mother Teresa, let alone even see her. So I get to Calcutta and spend a lot of time in the mother house, working in the home for the destitute and the dying, and in one of her orphanages. And I saw her almost every day at Mass, and she was great. She agreed to this interview, and again, this is in the enhanced e-book. You can see what she had to say to the questions that our students from the Bronx and South Bronx were asking her, and the footage in that enhanced e-book is raw. It's very cool, but it's raw.
Well, we spoke about how personal the book became, how I thought the book was very personal. And you do go into a lot of detail on how your faith, your Catholicism, really fueled a lot of what you did.
I did. My faith, I think, was one of the primary motivations for me early on. I saw the principles of liberation theology and social justice firmly embedded in Catholicism, and I saw the way I was living my life, and I saw the inconsistencies. And so, you know, that faith was really the impetus and really helped me to gain the courage I needed to start Build On and do what we did. Now, not long after I started Build On, that inspiration came directly from the people.
One that made an impression on me, and it sounded like on you too, was the woman named Komba. Could you tell us how you came to know her?
Sure. Well, that's not a short story, but I'll do my best. I was in one of the schools that we built in Mali in West Africa, and it was about 10 o'clock at night or something, and it's still 100 degrees. And during the daytime, the kids are in the classroom with teachers. At nighttime, we run literacy classes, and it's standing room only, Bob. These people are in the aisles, sitting in the aisles, sitting in the desks, in the windows, with this insatiable appetite for knowledge, for education, learning to read and write. So Komba Dumbia is in the front row, and I see her learning to hold a piece of chalk or a pencil for the first time and write her name. And I found out that she had two granddaughters that were in the school. And I said to her, almost naively, I said, wow, you must be very proud. Because gender discrimination is so prominent in that part of Africa. And she said, I'm proud, but I'm also ashamed. And I said, ashamed? Why are you ashamed? And she said, because I've lived most of my life in the darkness of illiteracy. And I thought about that, you know, shame and illiteracy and putting those together, and got to know her much more deeply. And it turns out that she was refused education as a little girl. She was forced to marry a man she never met at the age of 15, became one of three wives. She was subjected to female genital mutilation. And the husband was physically abusive, and she lost 3 out of 5 of her children, died during childbirth or as children, and just had this traumatic life. And then when we went to build the school, she volunteered to be on the leadership committee of 6 women and 6 men to lead this project. And she had a crew that reported to her every week when she went out to the construction site. And she just became this powerful leader and became, you know, renowned in her village and then in the region, and as an important leader of the women, outlawed female genital mutilation in her village, and was able to get funding for this really important micro-enterprise initiative in her community successfully that's working extremely well. And she's, you know, become this remarkable woman and has stepped up. And just the last time I saw her, I reminded her of how she answered that question and said, why you told me why you were ashamed. Why were you proud? And she said, because now I'm living in the light. And then she wrote a note and gave it to me and said, please share this with everybody who's helped to make this possible. And it's a very profound message. It's very simple, but it's profound. And it says just a few words, thank you for bringing the light. And that's really what education is all about.
Jim Zielkowski is the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Build On. His new book is called Walk in Their Shoes, Can One Person Change the World? It's published by Simon & Schuster. You can learn more at buildon.org. If there are smokers in your family, does that mean you're likely to pick up the habit too? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Tobacco companies face such serious restrictions on advertising that you may wonder how they even acquire new customers. But as Michael Volo, assistant professor of sociology at Purdue University, explains, picking up the habit is a family affair.
In this article with my co-author, Dr. Jeremy Staff of Penn State, we examine the relationship between parent, sibling, and child cigarette smoking. The parents have been surveyed annually since they were high school freshmen in 1988 through 2011 and asked about their level of smoking. We found 4 patterns of smoking from ages 14 to 38. First were those who have consistently smoked heavily or more than half a pack daily since high school. Second were those who smoke lightly in high school or about 1 to 5 cigarettes daily and reduced or quit by age 38. Third were those who didn't start smoking until their early 20s and continue to smoke at some level. Finally, representing half of the adults are consistent non-smokers. Each of the smoking categories represent about 15% of the adults. We then began to survey this original cohort's children who were ages 11 or older. We looked at whether the children have smoked within the last year in 2011. Surprisingly, we found very similar smoking rates for children of the 3 smoking groups of adults. That is, whether they were heavy or light smokers or started early or late. That rate was between 23 and 29%. Compare this to the children of non-smokers, whose rate was only 8%. Since we have all the children in the household, we also looked at the effect of siblings, finding that having an older sibling who smokes increased the chances of a younger sibling smoking by 6 times. Additionally, these older smoking siblings were 15 times more likely to be present in households with heavy smoking parents compared to non-smoking households. So both parental smoking patterns and sibling smoking matter for whether a child smokes.
That was Michael Volo of Purdue University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.